Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. When labor economist David Card began studying the minimum wage in the 1980s, the conventional wisdom in economics about how labor markets worked was heavily dependent on pen and paper theories from the 1920s. Those theories said things like, if the minimum wage goes up, fewer people will have jobs. But in a series of moves that quietly revolutionized the way economics would be practiced, Card and his colleague Alan Krueger began looking at real-world data from fast food restaurants in neighboring towns in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. And they found that raising the minimum wage didn't kill off jobs. This type of quote-unquote natural experiment allowed Card to probe complex economic mysteries and provide insight on policy changes. David Card joins us to talk about his work, the quote, credibility revolution in economics that it helped spawn, and winning with Stanford professor Guido Imbens and Joshua Angris from MIT the Nobel Prize in Economics. Welcome to the show, Professor Card.
Thank you.
So first of all, congratulations. And I want to ask you about some of these kind of key studies that led to this win, or early work, and then we'll kind of work up from there. So first, can you just kind of tell us about this minimum wage study in New Jersey and Pennsylvania?
Sure. So at the time I was teaching at Princeton, Alan and I were both professors there. And we had both done a little bit of work on minimum wages. And while we were reading the newspaper, we noticed that New Jersey legislature just passed a bill to raise the state minimum wage to $5.05. And at the time, everyone was at the federal minimum was $4.25. So we realized that this could be a chance to design a study that might be informative, really, and incredible about the effect of the minimum wage. So we quickly recruited a surveying team, and we surveyed a bunch of restaurants in New Jersey and nearby Pennsylvania, the part of Pennsylvania along the border. And then the minimum wage went up, and then we resurveyed the same restaurants 9 or 10 months later. And then we basically just tabulated up the results and said, okay, what happened to employment store by store? Was there more job losses in Pennsylvania than New Jersey? That's basically it.
And how was it received? Like, did other economists just go like, oh, great, overturning, 80 years of theory? Like, how did they take it?
Well, kind of a mixed reaction, I would say, maybe one quarter positive, three quarters negative. So at the time at Princeton, we had my senior colleague, Orly Ashenfelter, who's still professor there. He'd been kind of preaching this idea that we needed to try and get economics onto a more solid empirical framework. And he had been advocating for the use of experiments in a different context. And you can't really do an experiment on minimum wages, but you can do what we did. And so he was supportive. Some of our other colleagues, there was an old time professor at Berkeley, at Princeton, who had worked on the minimum wage in the 1940s, named Richard Lester. And he had always argued that the minimum wage didn't have these huge employment effects, but he was sort of overwhelmed by the, the noise of the crowd, I think. So anyway, we had our fans, but a lot of other people weren't so happy.
And, you know, as I understand it, you actually don't see just the pure finding that that jobs went away. It's kind of like the real message of that study. Like, that you actually see kind of that this was part of a deeper message about the flexibility that companies have in setting wages.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty important to understand that the textbook models that you mentioned in your introduction from the 1920s, they are predicated on the idea that firms don't have any discretion setting wages. There's essentially a wage out there for a given worker. And if you want to hire that person, you pay that wage. If you pay less than that, they won't come. If you pay more than that, you're kind of wasting your money. And so that's on that setting, then all these predictions about negative effects of minimum wages rise. But in a more realistic setting, like everyone's kind of familiar with who's ever had a real job, employer has some discretion in setting wage, maybe not a huge range, maybe a significant range. And We can see right now, for instance, a lot of employers are desperately trying to recruit workers, and they're using a combination of incentives, bonuses, incentives for coworkers to bring somebody in. And in that setting, you might say, well, why don't they just raise the wage? And of course, the answer is, if they raise the wage, it's true they'll get more workers, but they also have to pay more to the existing workforce. And so they're kind of doing a trade-off between those two. And in those kind of settings, if you force them to raise wages, they'll have more workers and you will get an increase in employment. And we thought of our work as trying to basically overturn the idea that firms don't have any discretion in setting wages.
We're talking with Berkeley economist David Card, who was awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics last week. He's also director of the Labor Studies Program at the National Bureau of Economic Research. And we want your questions for Nobel laureate David Card. You know, how has the rise in minimum wage affected your life? And do you just have any questions about the current state of labor economics? Give us a call, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or you can email your questions to forum@kqed.org. I want to talk about one other classic study of yours, which was on this boat lift of Cuban refugees into Miami. And the way that you used it is kind of a natural experiment to probe the effect of immigration on workers already in the country. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. So again, setting was I'd done some research on immigration before. And the focus of my work was really on whether it was the case that arrival of immigrants, especially lower skilled immigrants, had a negative effect on native workers. It was very difficult to isolate that in a kind of straightforward way. And then I found out about the boat lift. I learned about it from a student at Princeton, actually, and realized that this would be a good opportunity. So I just did a very straightforward thing. I found a set of cities, which when you average them together, kind of looked like Miami in the past. So I created kind of an artificial Miami using a combination of other cities, in Houston and Tampa and Atlanta and LA, I think it was. And those cities would form essentially the Pennsylvania for this experiment. And then the boat lift happened. A pretty large number of people, about 75, 80,000 people stayed in Miami as a result of the boat lift. And it happened overnight. So it was a really stark shock. And I then followed over the next 5 years what happened to wages and unemployment rates, specifically focusing on lower skilled workers and minority workers in Miami, which had a very diverse labor market at the time.
So when you do a study like that and you see its effect, you publish it, do you expect it to have a major policy impact? And which of your pieces of research do you think have had the largest impact on the way that the labor market is regulated in the United States?
Well, normally what happens is you do a study, you write it up, and it's very difficult to know whether it's going to have even an impact on the economists, let alone on the policy sphere. For instance, in the case of the minimum wage work that Alan and I did, really, after that, there wasn't much going on with the, you know, the federal minimum wage kind of stalled out. There was a small increase some years later, but you could, if you looked at the data, you might say that our work basically prevented a rise in the federal minimum wage. We always made a laugh about that. But later on, it maybe things start to change. People pick up the idea a little bit. So you see some evidence of change. The most recent thing I've done that probably had the most immediate impact was studying a situation in another place in Broward County, Florida, which is basically Fort Lauderdale area. And they had tried to expand their gifted program for elementary school children. And gifted programs are very controversial, as I'm sure you know. And one of the reasons why they're so controversial is very few minority students are in those programs. And Broward did a really amazing thing. They basically screened every second grader. And we just did this with Laura Giuliano at Santa Cruz. And Laura and I basically just got the data and looked at who did they find? What were the extra gifted kids that were located with the Universal Screening Program? And we found that a very large fraction of them were Black and Hispanic kids from poorer families. And so it really suggested that the reason why there's low participation in gifted programs is at least in part driven by the talented kids are not being identified. And that had an immediate impact. A bunch of school districts immediately got interested.
That's so interesting. We have some listener questions and comments. I want to go first to a comment a listener asks. I'm seeing so many help wanted signs with jobs that pay well over minimum wage, $19 an hour at In-N-Out, for example. It's probably in San Francisco. And I wondered if this rise in wages is contributing to inflation. My grocery bill seems to be rising. A loaf of bread that used to be $4.50 is now $5.75. Are wages and inflation related?
Well, that's actually a long-standing question, whether wages drive inflation or whether wages follow behind inflation. Right now, I think the most recent data I saw suggested that although wages have been rising, they haven't been rising as fast as prices. So real wages adjusted for inflation are actually, for most workers, falling. There is a concern, I guess, that back when I was an undergraduate and even into graduate years in the late 70s, there was a pretty strong burst of inflation in many countries. And there's a concern, some economists, that we might advance into that kind of situation where both wages and prices start to rise in what they call a spiral. It's not something I totally confident that we know enough about to say for sure. So I personally think it's unlikely, but it's possible it's true, will happen.
I'd like to add in caller Keith from Palo Alto. Welcome to the show.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Can you hear me fine?
Yeah, sure can. Go ahead, Keith.
Great. So my question for the Nobel laureate is, now that his work has been recognized in this way, do you think that it will result in a change at the policy level, in particular a reduction in the objection to raising the national minimum wage that seems to be very common among Republican politicians?
Thank you for that,
Keith.
I'll
take my answer off the air.
Wonderful. Thank you. David Carden?
Yeah, that's a good question, Keith. No, I don't think it'll have any effect. Actually, we did as part of a book that Alan Kruger and I did when we followed up on our that study. We looked at voting choices for minimum wages, and there was some really good ironies. For instance, in the just after that time we wrote the book, there was a vote on a federal minimum wage, and all the Republican delegation from California voted against it, even though the minimum wage in California was already higher than what they were proposing to raise the federal minimum to. So minimum wage is an example of what political scientists call symbolic politics. It's really very symbolic, and it's not, you know, I think the choices are your party chooses one side or the other side, and you kind of stuck with that.
Yeah. You know, I'm curious what we don't understand. You've been studying this labor market for so long, and obviously the labor market has a huge effect on inequality, income, and wealth. What don't we understand about what's generating higher levels of inequality than we saw in the past?
Oh, enormous amount of stuff we don't understand. One thing we really don't understand fully is whether workers at the very top have some incredibly unique skill. I mean, are they the Clint Eastwoods of their profession, or are they just basically lucky? And, you know, it's probably an element of both of those there, but is it 90% luck and 10% extraordinary talent, or the other way around? And it's very difficult to discern that. We can see, we're starting to get more and more data from different sources that allow us to follow the same worker as they move across their careers. And people are really getting interested in to what extent we should be thinking about it as talent or luck or what combination. And that really influences a lot about, you know, does it matter if we tax it? If it's just luck, then it doesn't matter nearly as much if we tax it. So that I think will ultimately be a very important question.
You know, you've mentioned a couple of times new data coming into the field and really kind of leading the transformation of the theory. What are the big kind of sources of this new data that have allowed you to kind of do more in different types of experiments?
Well, there's probably two main sources. One is the government, federal government or state governments are always collecting data for regulatory purposes and tax purposes. And that data can be used to study all kinds of things. For instance, the state of California has one of the world's best health-related data sets. So every time a baby is born, there's a record created of what happened in the hospital, what happened to the mother, and some information from the birth certificate. And then that's matched together with like information on whether the, if the baby was to die over the next year or two, and subsequent visits to the hospital by that baby or by the mother. And I've used that kind of data in looking at whether babies born delivered by C-section have worse health outcomes. But you can put together all that data because it's basically being collected anyway as part of a regulation system. And that's starting to be made available to researchers. Similarly, tax data, the unemployment insurance system taxes everyone in the country. Mm-hmm. And that tax record data is used. I have a new study looking at whether when you adjust for the cost of living, are wages higher or lower in San Francisco relative to other places. The other source, of course, is things like the internet. There's just an amazing amount of data being created there.
So thinking about those sources of data, what areas of economics are you think most likely to undergo, major revolutions over the coming years?
I think my own field will continue to be a leader. Most of the people in the field are very aware of new data and are really interested in different hypotheses. We're making a lot of progress, I think, in understanding changes in the gender gap, the wage gap between male and female workers, partially because of this new data. We're making some progress on understanding differences between white and non-white workers or by ethnicity. That is a little harder because the distribution of those workers is pretty skewed across different places. We're making good progress in understanding sources of differences in children's outcomes as they age. And I think we're going to see a lot more work on that in the next 10, 15 years, where we can see children growing up in neighborhoods, things happen in that neighborhood, something happens to the other kids in that neighborhood, how that ends up affecting those children, and really understanding those sources of neighborhood differences. In a place like San Francisco, they're just very, very visible and everyone is very aware of them. And understanding what the neighborhood really does is probably a new frontier.
And what about the internet data? Do you plan on making use of that in future studies?
I have done some research using things like internet data. I did a study a few years ago with some colleagues at Berkeley where the salary information for everybody in the UC system was put online by the Sacramento Bee. And that was just going to happen or just happened. And we surveyed people and said, are you aware of this, salary data? We nudged people basically in the treatment group of the experiment to take a look at the ZACB website. And then we asked a few weeks later, amongst the treatment group versus the control group, who we didn't nudge, we asked, is there any evidence that the people who found out about the salaries of their coworkers were dissatisfied with their job or more satisfied with their job? So we did a study like that.
Wow, so interesting. We're talking with Berkeley economist David Card, who was awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics. He's also director of the Labor Studies Program at the National Bureau of Economic Research. What are your questions for Nobel laureate David Card? Give us a call now, 866-733-6786. Anything about the labor market? I feel like he's your guy. That's 866-733-6786. Or you can get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. Or you can email your questions to forum@kqed.org. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We'll be back after a short break. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking with Berkeley economist David Card, who was awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics. A listener wants to ask you, California seems to have competitive wages, but is losing workers and companies to other states like Texas because housing costs are so high. What is Card's take on that? We can keep raising the minimum wage, but if you can't afford a house, this is not a state you can live in. And I'd love you just to take that to the place of what What do we know about the relationship between wages, housing costs, and, you know, these kind of cities, superstar cities that have done so well?
Well, actually, interestingly enough, I just finished a paper on that, circulated a couple weeks ago, before the Nobel Prize. And we were looking at workers as they moved across different cities. And we could see a very important fact that's helpful in understanding what's going on. It turns out that the workers, many of the workers in a place like San Francisco would earn more no matter where they were. So there's a part of the earnings gap that you see for cities like San Francisco or New York that is really driven by the underlying characteristics of the worker. Now, on top of that, the same worker gets some premium for living in a higher wage city or a larger city, but the premium isn't nearly big enough to cover the fact that housing costs are so much higher. We estimate, usually economists say, if the housing costs are 10% higher, then you need like a 3% higher wage, something like 3-4%. So you need to have about a third of that reimbursed in your salary. And
but if the housing costs are 300% higher.
Yeah, exactly. And wages are somewhat higher in San Francisco, but nowhere like 100%. So our study really confirmed results. And actually an earlier finding by my colleague Enrico Moretti, who I think has been on the show before, he'd suggested this exact finding, and our result basically said, you know, Moretti is right, and it's even stronger than you think, because if you look at the San Francisco workers, they're the kind of workers who would earn more everywhere, and we're not really compensating for their higher cost nearly as much as you would think.
Huh. So what do we do with that finding? Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, in that setting, I think you have to understand, so why are people in San Francisco?
Right.
And I'm sure many listeners wonder that. I think what's going on to some extent is there's some investment. You know, you're a younger worker. If you're going to work in the tech sector, you can probably do well by spending 10 years or maybe a little bit less in this area, and then maybe move out to a lower cost area. So some of it might be an investment that you're making, and in that setting, there's always going to be turnover. So the young people are going to come in, they're going to work in the sector and then go out, as you would see in finance in New York and maybe in the entertainment sector in LA, same kind of thing. So there's a bit of that going on, but it's kind of a mystery.
It's a beautiful place. That's why, Professor Card.
Well, for sure, that's true.
Yeah. Got a couple of questions on the other end of the pay scale. Murta writes, what about wages at the tippy top in a business? For example, I just looked up the annual salary of the CEO of Kaiser Permanente. It's $16 million. Anything to be said about that? And Brian writes, can your guest address a strong minimum wage effect versus a smaller ratio between highest and lowest wages? So trying to compress that tippy top and the very bottom.
Yeah, I think that's a concern that many people have and are really wonder about. It's somewhat related to the point I made earlier about, like, is this talent? Is this an unbelievable talent or just luck? I think that there's going to be some interesting possibilities. A number of countries have introduced legislation which firms have to report how the CEO salary varies relative to the average salary in the company. And so it's kind of like the Sacramento Bee episode, where suddenly we'll know a little bit more how the salaries compare of different workers and whether a firm is one that tends to be highly unequal or somewhat more equal. I don't know whether that'll have an effect or not. The big rise in CEO salaries that occurred between mid-80s and today, no one really has a perfect idea of why that happened. And it's possible that there'll be some interesting research on that coming up. But to tell you the truth, I tend to work on the lower end of the labor market. I think there's actually quite a few people who work on the high end. I think it's pretty important to have, you know, scholars working on the low end, and that's the people we really care about, I think, in the end.
You know, one of the things that I noted, you know, in listening to some of your lectures, you kind of pointed out there is this sort of direct relationship between worker wages and company profits and prices as well. And so we have one of our listeners would like to know about that. Karen writes, I'm always surprised that low wages are not talked about from the perspective that workers making low wages are subsidizing low prices. Low wages allow the low prices in fast food restaurants at Walmart. Why should workers subsidize low prices? And I was hoping maybe you could kind of talk about that triangle and why we think we have the particular combination now of low wages, low prices, and high company profits when presumably it could be there could be some other configuration.
You know, that's a really good question. I think the U.S. labor market has tended to really privilege low-wage jobs. We, for instance, for many, many years, we didn't require them to have healthcare benefits. And people who work in those jobs are effectively getting all kinds of subsidies from things like food stamp program or subsidized health insurance. So the economy is actually subsidizing low-wage jobs rather than trying to incentivize the opposite. And so I think you have to understand that there's benefits to low-wage jobs, for instance, in agriculture, the huge benefit that we all get from, you know, amazing produce at the Berkeley Bowl that's kept reasonably priced. But the cost of that is that there's a lot of workers that are earning low wages. And I guess if you thought, well, those workers are earning much more here than they would in Guatemala or Mexico, or if they're mostly immigrant workers, which they are, then that might be a good deal. But if in the longer run, we would hope that everyone would kind of move up the wage distribution. And I think we're going to see over the next 10 years a gradual, careful discussion about this and possibly some gains for workers at the bottom of the wage distribution. That set of workers have really suffered over the last 30 years pretty substantially, and it's possible that that's going to change.
That's one of the most hopeful things anyone's ever said on the show, David Card. Thank you for that. Let's bring in Mike from San Jose. Welcome to the show, Mike. Hey, Mike, can you hear us?
Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, we can.
Hey, thank you. Just a quick question. With the workforce being so low due to, like, government assistance and whatnot, why not give government incentives to people who are working? Would that help to lower the unemployment and increase the workforce?
Actually, that's a good question, Mike. There is such a program. That's the Earned Income Tax Credit. And it's actually a very big part of federal spending on support for lower-income families. And it provides, the way it works is if you work a little bit, you get kind of a boost up to a certain point, up to, you know, into the 20s income. And people who've studied that, including my colleague at Berkeley, Hillary Hoynes, they found that that had a positive effect on getting women to work, mothers to work, and without too much negative effect on other workers. So there's a lot of interest in expanding those kind of programs. They are expensive. That's the one thing, because almost everybody's working, you know, so if you give money to people that are working, it's going to cost a lot.
Couple more comments and just really solid questions for you. Curtis writes, immigration has historically solved our shortage of low wage labor. How important is the steady supply of immigrants to the labor market?
Good question, Curtis. I think that's actually a very important question. I suspect that if this current situation is that we've really shut off some of those flows and the numbers of people who are available to come are diminishing. So, you know, there's not a birth rate in Mexico is quite low. And so there's not such a huge number of people as there were 40 years ago, just willing to move in and take really low wage jobs. And I suspect that that will have long run effects on industries like construction, agriculture, and even on things like Uber, Lyft, all the delivery service businesses that have started up. Those businesses were kind of set up in a world where there was all kinds of low-skilled workers available and people that really needed an extra gig for a few hours a week, earning, you know, 15, 20 bucks an hour. And to the extent that starts to dry up, I think we're going to see a lot of rethinking of how those sectors work.
Another listener writes, Joe, does your guest have any thoughts on universal basic income?
You know, that's interesting. That's a subject that was studied in the 1970s, believe it or not. We had a couple of big, some of the first experiments, real randomized experiments in economics were basic income experiments. And they found a couple of things. They found that if you gave a basic income grant and then had a system of taking it back, so people with higher incomes, like the ones that are being tested out in different places around North America right now, it has a small disincentive for work, but it's also quite costly. And so at the end of the day, I think what was decided after as a result of those experiments was it was maybe not quite as much of a panacea as advocates for it thought. It was extremely popular. Milton Friedman, the famous conservative economist, was really one of the big advocates of an income negative income tax. We call it a negative income tax rather than a universal basic. And so that system is popular among economists, but it is expensive. Actually, to tell you the truth, the earned income tax credit is a version of that.
Right. And even a lot of universal basic income advocates have started calling it an expanded earned income tax credit. Let's bring in Daniel from West Sacramento.
Hi. We have such a myopic view of work and culture and economics in this country. What if we were to stimulate the creation of more and more cooperative businesses, like, for example, the Mondragon societies in northern Spain? What is your point of view about expanding our view of work, workforce, and the whole job situation by creating more cooperative businesses?
Thank you so much, Daniel. And you know, where I would take this question to, David Card, is can we change the nature of the firms that run the economy? Or do you see them as more or less fixed and that their behavior is not going to change a lot to, say, change the split in profits and worker wages?
Yeah, that's a good question. There was actually the co-op movement really got going in the Great Depression in the U.S. And, you know, it was a response to the great difficulties that emerged then. My father was a farmer and was a member of a farmer's co-op. And that's where we bought a lot of supplies for our farm when I was a kid. There was some success in that sector in the forestry industry, or there was in Washington State. Those organizations have trouble raising capital. I think that's the one thing, and the banks and so on are probably somewhat more difficult to convince that a cooperative organization is going to be well run and make hard-nosed business decisions in the future. So that it takes a while, I think, to convince things. I don't think there's a reason why they couldn't be broader, but my understanding is that they've become a little less popular than they were in the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. There used to be cooperative grocery stores, for instance, in Chicago, and I think they're gone now.
So I have some questions about other factors in our economy here, particularly on low-wage work. And one thing we haven't talked about is the gig economy and its sort of weirding of work, particularly at the lower end of the wage spectrum. What does the kind of current economics research tell us about the effect that, you know, your Ubers and your delivery drivers are having on that kind of work?
Well, it seems like most people who are doing that work from the research I've seen are doing it on a part-time basis. So U.S. is a different economy than many European countries in that there's a fairly large number of people who have two jobs. There's even people with three. And that's one way that lower income people cope in the U.S. context where we don't have, you know, big generous social programs. And so I think the way we think about those jobs as part-time extra work for most people. There are some people who make it a full-time job. And I think there's parts of that need to be really thought out. For instance, the regulation of the taxi industry historically was highly regulated, thinking, well, we want to regulate taxis to reduce traffic congestion. And then we all of a sudden turn off all of that. And now we've got, you know, there's some recent studies suggesting that maybe that's resulted in more traffic than, you know, than we fully understood. So historically, I think we had a more holistic view about many of these sectors and said, okay, we're going to try and make sure that we balance, you know, the number of workers and the benefits that they get and the rights that they have. And the tech sector kind of took advantage of some loopholes and really expanded quickly in a kind of a frontier way. And I think there's going to be a lot of re-litigation of that over the next 10 years.
Early in the show, you also talked about making progress on understanding the wage gap between white and non-white workers and between genders. Can you tell us more about like what that progress has been and what it tells us about, say, structural racism in labor markets?
Yeah, so I recently completed a study looking at white and non-white workers in Brazil. Brazil is the other country in the world that has a, you know, very large number of Africans who were brought in as slaves. And so it has about 50% of the population is non-white. And it has a, you know, not quite an advanced labor market, but fairly modern in most places. And so it's a great opportunity to study. We can't start these studies yet. We don't quite have the data to do this in the United States. But I was interested in the question of, to what extent does the hiring policies of firms affect the non-white wage gap? So we're all aware that some firms pay more than others. It's kind of related to what I talked about at the very beginning about pay discretion. So, and everybody as they go through the labor market is hoping to get a job at a higher paying firm. I mean, in academia, you'd like to move from Berkeley to Stanford. Everybody kind of knows that. And so
can you say that as a Berkeley professor? I'm not sure you can.
Well, I'm close to retirement, so it doesn't matter for me. But so everybody's kind of aware of that. And the question is, to what extent do the discrimination by hiring agents mean that non-whites are stuck at the lower points on the job ladder? We call this set of firms the job ladder. And we found that in the Brazilian context, that was a pretty big chunk of the non-white wage gap. So if you could open up the doors, you would find some opportunities. And a really interesting follow-on to that, I have a grad student at Berkeley who's done just the most amazing study looking at what happens if a company is owned by a non-white in Brazil. And it turns out that those firms are the ones that hire more non-whites, particularly for management type jobs. So his research really suggests, or it's actually two grad students, Martina and Roberto, and they've got a just amazing finding that it looks like, you know, having more non-white ownership would really be beneficial for non-whites wanting to move up the food chain in the labor market. And so it's very closely related to this big concern. Why are there so few non-white entrepreneurs? And is there some problem that's preventing them from creating wealth, like the problems in the housing market? So it's all kind of interconnected.
Thank you so much. We've been talking with UC Berkeley labor economist David Card, who was awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics last week. Congratulations again, and thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum Ahead with host Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.
Do you love your local bookstore? Well, I have the perfect event for you. This Saturday, April 27th, is Independent Bookstore Day. It's a day to celebrate your favorite local bookstore. I'm Olivia Allen Price, host of the Bay Curious podcast here at KQED, and I'm popping in to let you know that we will be hosting an event at Green Apple Books in San Francisco for the occasion. Come out for an author Q&A about the Bay Curious book. We'll be playing some Bay Area-themed trivia. There will be prizes and so much more. And the best part, tickets are donation-based, and all proceeds go to the Prisoners Literature Project. Learn more at kqed.org/live. I hope to see you there.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.